There, a nice mild-mannered man will hand you a softball-sized chunk of what seems to be a building material and ask you to guess what it is. About $10 worth of ersatz marble from Home Depot, you might guess. Whereupon he explains that what appears to be Home Depot marble becomes, under certain conditions, an explosive powerful enough to trigger a chain reaction in a pile of plutonium. The secret that the mild-mannered man would get thrown in jail for sharing is exactly what those conditions are. That was another thing that surprised McWilliams when he went to work at the DOE, the sheer amount of classified information. You couldn't really function without being cleared to hear it. There were places in the building where you could share national secrets and places where you could not. The people from the FBI who had vetted him for his security clearance had made it very clear to him that they would excuse many foibles, affairs, petty crimes, drug use, but they could not excuse even the most trivial deception. They asked a battery of questions on the order of, "Have you ever known anyone who has advocated the violent overthrow of the United States government?" They'd asked him to list every contact with foreigners he had had in the past 7 years, which was absurd, as he had spent a career in global finance and lived in both London and Paris. But the people who handed out security clearances failed to see the humor in it. They wanted to know everything. There was no way anyone who obtained a security clearance would find it not worth mentioning that, say, he'd recently dined with the Russian ambassador. Sitting at his kitchen table with me, McWilliams picks up his cell phone. "We're a major target of espionage," he says. "You just have to assume that you are being monitored all the time." I look around. We're surrounded by a lot of green Long Island tranquility. "By who?" I ask, with what I hope is a trace of scorn. "The Russians, the Chinese." "How?" "Every phone I have, every computer." Outside, on his back lawn, overlooking a lovely estuary, McWilliams had placed silhouettes of wild beasts to deter Canada geese from landing. I laugh. "You seriously think someone might be listening to us right now?" "I may have dropped off their radar," he says, "but you are definitely monitored while you are there." I check my watch. I have important op-eds to write, and perhaps a few meetings with people who might know the Koch brothers. If I'm a Trump person, I'm going to assume the people in charge of the nuclear weapons are sufficiently alive to the risks around them that they don't need Rick Perry's help. After all, the only thing Trump had to say publicly about Rick Perry during the campaign was that he should be forced to take an IQ test and that he puts glasses on so people think he's smart. "What's the second risk on your list?" I ask. "North Korea would be up there," says McWilliams. "Why do I, as an incoming official at the DOE, need to be worried about North Korea?" McWilliams explains, patiently, that there lately have been signs that the risk of some kind of attack by North Korea is increasing. The missiles the North Koreans have been firing into the sea are not the absurd acts of a lunatic mind, but experiments. Obviously, the DOE is not the only agency inside the U.S. government trying to make sense of these experiments, but the people inside the national labs are the world's most qualified to determine just what North Korea's missiles can do. "For a variety of reasons, the risk curve has changed," says McWilliams guardedly. "The risk of mistakes being made and lots of people being killed is increasing dramatically. It wouldn't necessarily be a nuclear weapon they might deliver. It could be sarin gas." As he doesn't want to go into further detail and maybe divulge information I am not clear to hear, I press him to move on. "Okay, give me the third risk on your list." "This is in no particular order," he says with remarkable patience. "But Iran is somewhere in the top five." He'd watched Secretary Moniz help negotiate the deal that removed from Iran the capacity to acquire a nuclear weapon. There were only three paths to a nuclear weapon. The Iranians might produce enriched uranium, but that required using centrifuges. They might produce plutonium, but that required a reactor that the deal had dismantled and removed. Or they might simply go out and buy a weapon on the open market. The national labs played a big role in policing all three paths. "These labs are incredible national resources, and they are directly responsible for keeping us safe," said McWilliams. "It's because of them that we can say with absolute certainty that Iran cannot surprise us with a nuclear weapon." After the deal was done, U.S. Army officers had approached DOE officials to thank them for saving American lives. The deal, they felt sure, had greatly lessened the chance of yet another war in the Middle East that the United States would inevitably be dragged into. At any rate, the serious risk in Iran wasn't that the Iranians would secretly acquire a weapon. It was that the President of the United States would not understand his nuclear scientists' reasoning about the unlikelihood of the Iranians obtaining a weapon, and that he would have the United States back away foolishly from the deal, which is exactly what he did. Released from the complicated set of restrictions on its nuclear power program, Iran would then build its bomb. It wasn't enough to have the world's finest forensic nuclear physicists. Our political leaders needed to be predisposed to listen to them and equipped to understand what they said. "Yeah, well, never mind science. We'll deal with Iran," I could hear some Trump person thinking to himself. By early summer of 2017, I had spoken with 20 or so of the people who had run the department, along with a handful of career people. All of them understood their agency as a powerful tool for dealing with the most alarming risks facing humanity. All thought the tool was being badly mishandled and at risk of being busted. They'd grown used to the outside world, not particularly knowing or caring what they did, unless they screwed up, at which point they became the face of government waste or stupidity. "No one notices when something goes right," as Max Steyer put it to me. "There is no bright spot analysis." How can an organization survive that stresses and responds only to the worst stuff that happens inside it? How does it encourage more of the best stuff if it doesn't reward it? The $70 billion loan program that John McWilliams had been hired to evaluate was a case in point. It had been authorized by Congress in 2005 to lend money at very low interest rates to businesses so that they might develop game-changing energy technologies. The idea that the private sector underinvests in energy innovation is part of the origin story of the DOE. "The basic problem is that there is no constituency for an energy program," James Schlesinger, the first Secretary of Energy, said as he left the job. "There are many constituencies opposed. Existing energy businesses, oil companies, utilities, are obviously hostile to government-sponsored competition. At the same time, they are essentially commodity businesses without a lot of fat in them. The stock market does not reward even big oil companies for research and development that will take decades to pay off. And the sort of research that might lead to huge changes in energy production often doesn't pay off for decades. Plus, it requires a lot of expensive science. Discovering a new kind of battery or a new way of capturing solar energy is not like creating a new app. Fracking, to take one example, was not the brainchild of private sector research, but the fruit of research paid for 20 years ago by the DOE. Yet fracking has collapsed the price of oil and gas and led to American energy independence. Solar and wind technologies are another example. The Obama administration set a goal in 2009 of getting the cost of utility-scale solar energy down by 2020 from 27 cents a kilowatt hour to 6 cents. It's now at 7 cents and competitive with natural gas because of loans made by the DOE. "The private sector only steps in once DOE shows it can work," said Franklin Orr, a Stanford professor of engineering who took a 2-year leave of absence to oversee the DOE's science programs. John McWilliams had enjoyed success in the free market that the employees of the Heritage Foundation might only fantasize about, but he had a far less Panglossian view of its inner workings. "Government has always played a major role in innovation," he said, "all the way back to the founding of the country. Early-stage innovation in most industries would not have been possible without government support in a variety of ways, and it's especially true in energy. So the notion that we are just going to privatize early-stage innovation is ridiculous. Other countries are outspending us in R&D, and we are going to pay a price." Politically, the loan program had been nothing but downside. No one had paid any attention to its successes, and its one failure, Solyndra, had allowed the right-wing friends of big oil to bang on relentlessly about government waste and fraud and stupidity. A single bad loan had turned a valuable program into a political liability. As he dug into the portfolio, McWilliams feared it might contain other Solyndras. It didn't. But what he did find still disturbed him. The DOE had built a loan portfolio that, as McWilliams put it, J.P. Morgan would have been happy to own. The whole point was to take big risks the market would not take. And they were making money. "We weren't taking nearly enough risk," said McWilliams. The fear of losses that might in turn be twisted into anti-government propaganda was threatening the mission. In late June 2017, I went for a long drive in hopes of getting a clearer picture of risks 4 and 5, which McWilliams had gone on to describe for me at greater length. Urgent threats to American life that might just then have been keeping the leadership of Trump's DOE awake at night, if there had been any leadership. I started out in Portland, Oregon, heading east along the Columbia River. An hour or so into the drive, the forests vanish and are replaced by desolate scrubland. It's a startling sight, a great river flowing through a desert. Every so often I pass a dam so massive it's as if full-scale replicas of the Department of Energy's building in Washington, D.C. had been dropped into the river. The Columbia is postcard lovely, but it is also an illustration of McWilliams' fourth risk, the electrical grid. The river and its tributaries generate more than 40% of the hydroelectric power for the United States. Were the dams to fail, the effects would be catastrophic. The safety of the electrical grid sat at or near the top of the list of concerns of everyone I spoke with inside the DOE. Life in America has become increasingly reliant on it. Food and water has become food and water and electricity, as one DOE career staffer put it. Back in 2013, there had been an incident in California that got everyone's attention. Late one night, just southeast of San Jose, at Pacific Gas and Electric's Metcalf substation, a well-informed sniper, using a .30-caliber rifle, had taken out 17 transformers. Someone had also cut the cables that enabled communication to and from the substation. They knew exactly what lines to cut, said Tarek Shaw, who studied the incident for the DOE. They knew exactly where to shoot. They knew exactly which manhole covers were relevant, where the communication lines were. These were feeder stations to Apple and Google. There had been enough backup power in the area that no one noticed the outage, and the incident came and went quickly from the news. But, Shaw said, for us it was a wake-up call. In 2016, the DOE counted 500,000 cyber intrusions into various parts of the U.S. electrical grid. It's one thing to put your head in the sand for climate change. It's like manana, says Ali Zaidi, who served in the White House as Obama's senior advisor on energy policy. This is here and now. We actually don't have a transformer reserve. They're like these million-dollar things. 17 transformers getting shot up in California is not like, oh, we'll just fix the problem. Our electric grid assets are growing vulnerable. In his briefings on the electrical grid, McWilliams made a specific point and a more general one. The specific point was that we don't actually have a national grid. Our electricity is supplied by a patchwork of not terribly innovative or imaginatively managed regional utilities. The federal government offers the only hope of a coordinated, intelligent response to threats to the system. There is no private sector mechanism. To that end, the DOE had begun to gather the executives of the utility companies to educate them about the threats they face. They all sort of said, but is this really real? Said McWilliams. You get them security clearance for a day and tell them about the attacks, and all of a sudden you see their eyes go really wide. His more general point was that managing risks was an act of the imagination, and the human imagination is a poor tool for judging risk. People are really good at responding to the crisis that just happened, as they naturally imagine that whatever just happened is most likely to happen again. They are less good at imagining a crisis before it happens, and taking action to prevent it. For just this reason, the DOE under Secretary Moniz had set out to imagine disasters that had never happened before. One scenario was a massive attack on the grid on the eastern seaboard that forced millions of Americans to be relocated to the Midwest. Another was a Category 3 hurricane hitting Galveston, Texas. A third was a major earthquake in the Pacific Northwest that, among other things, shut off the power. Yet even then, the disasters they imagined were the sort of disasters that a Hollywood screenwriter might imagine. Vivid, dramatic events. McWilliams thought that while such things did happen, they were not the sole or even the usual source of catastrophe. What was most easily imagined was not what was most probable. It wasn't the things you think of when you try to think of bad things happening that got you killed, he said. It is the less detectable systemic risks. Another way of putting this is, the risk we should most fear is not the risk we easily imagine. It is the risk that we don't. Which brought us to the fifth risk. When you set out to list the major risks inside a place with a mission as nerve-wracking as the DOE's, your mind naturally seeks to order them. One crude way that McWilliams ordered the 150 or so risks on his final list was to plot them on a simple graph with two axes. On one axis was probability of an accident. On the other axis was consequences of an accident. He placed risks into one of the graph's four quadrants, a nuclear bomb exploding in an assembly plant and blowing up the Texas panhandle, high consequence, low probability. A person hopping a perimeter security fence at one of the DOE facilities, low consequence, high probability, and so on. Mainly, he wanted to make sure the department was paying sufficient attention to the risks that fell into the graph's most unpleasant quadrant, high probability of an accident, big consequences if it happens. He noticed that many of the risks that fell into this quadrant were giant multi-billion dollar projects managed by the DOE. McWilliams coined his own acronym, BAFU, billions and all fucked up. Anyway, when I had asked him for the fifth risk, he had thought about it and then seemed to relax a bit. The fifth risk did not put him at risk of revealing classified information. Project management was all he said. In December 1938, German scientists discovered uranium fission. Physicist Enrico Fermi's report on the Germans' work made its way to Albert Einstein, and in 1939, Einstein wrote a letter to Franklin Roosevelt. That letter is the founding document of the Department of Energy. By the early 1940s, the United States government understood that for democracy to survive, it needed to beat Hitler to the atom bomb. There were two ways to build such a bomb, with enriched uranium or with plutonium. In early 1943, the United States Army was evicting everyone from an area in eastern Washington nearly half the size of Rhode Island and setting out to create enough plutonium for a nuclear bomb. The site of Hanford was chosen in part for its proximity to the Columbia River. The river supplied both cooling water and electricity. Hanford was also chosen for its remoteness. The Army was worried about both enemy attacks and an accidental nuclear explosion. And finally, Hanford was chosen for its poverty. It was convenient that what would become the world's largest public works project arose in a place from which people had to be paid so little to leave. From 1943 until 1987, when Hanford closed its last reactor, the place created two-thirds of the plutonium in the United States arsenal. In that time, it supplied the material for 70,000 nuclear weapons. What was left behind after the fact was just as astonishing. Plutonium is hard to produce, said McWilliams, and hard to get rid of. By the late 1980s, the state of Washington had gained some clarity on just how hard. After a long and nasty negotiation, the U.S. government promised to return Hanford to a condition where, as McWilliams put it, kids can eat the dirt. More or less overnight, Hanford went from the business of making plutonium to the business of cleaning it up. In its last years as a working factory, the plutonium plant employed around 9,000 people. It still employs 9,000 people and pays them even more than it used to. It's a good thing that we live in a country that cares enough to take the time it will take and spend the money it will spend to clean up the legacy of the Cold War, said McWilliams. In Russia, they just drop concrete on the stuff and move on. Asked to guess what it might cost the U.S. government to return Hanford to the standards now legally required of it, McWilliams said, $100 billion. And that, he thought, might be a conservative estimate. Every year, the Department of Energy wires 10% of its budget, or $3 billion, into this tiny place. It will likely continue to do so until the radioactive mess is cleaned up. And even though what is now called the Tri-Cities area is well populated and amazingly prosperous, yachts on the river, $300 bottles of wine in the bistros, the absolute worst thing that could happen to it is probably not a nuclear accident. The worst thing that could happen is that the federal government loses interest in it and slashes the DOE's budget, as President Trump has proposed to do. And yet, Trump won the county in which Hanford resides by 25 points. One morning, with a pair of local guides, I drive into the DOE project most direly in need of management. In my lap is a book of instructions for visitors. Report any spill or release, it says, among other things. Nobody in the world has waste like ours, says one of my guides as we enter the site. No one has so much strontium-90, for instance, which behaves a lot like calcium and lodges inside the bones of any living creatures it penetrates, basically forever. Along with chromium and tritium and carbon tetrachloride and iodine-129 and the other waste products of a plutonium factory, it is already present in Hanford's groundwater. There are other nuclear waste sites in the United States, but two-thirds of all the waste is here. Beneath Hanford, a massive underground glacier of radioactive sludge is moving slowly but relentlessly toward the Columbia River. The place is now an eerie deconstruction site, with ghost towns on top of ghost towns. Much of the old plutonium plant still stands. The husks of the original 9 reactors, built in the 1940s, still line the Columbia River, like grain elevators. Their doors have been welded shut, and they have been left to decay for another century. Cold and dark is a term we like to use, says one of my guides, though he adds that rattlesnakes and other living creatures often find their way into the reactors. Of the settlement that existed before the government seized the land, there remain the stumps of trees from what were once orchards and the small stone shell of the town bank. There are older ghosts here, too. What looks like arid scrubland contains countless Indian burial grounds and other sites sacred to the tribes who lived here, the Nez Perce, the Umatilla, and the Yakima. For the 13,000 years or so prior to the white man's arrival, the place had been theirs. To them, the American experiment is no more than the blink of an eye. You have only been here 200 years, so you can only imagine 200 years into the future, as a Nez Perce spokesman put it to me. We have been here tens of thousands of years, and we will be here forever. One day we will again eat the roots. Maybe so. But in 2014, the DOE sent the local tribes a letter to say that, never mind the roots, they shouldn't even eat, more than once a week, the fish they caught in the river. A young elk gallops across the road in front of our car. Hunting hasn't been allowed on the 586-square-mile tract since 1943, and so there's game everywhere. Geese, ducks, cougars, rabbits, elk, and deer. For a shockingly long time, the effects of radiation on living creatures were either ignored or insincerely explored. No one in the frantic race to create nuclear weapons wanted to hear anything that might slow him down. But over the years, people who lived downwind of Hanford experienced unusually high rates of miscarriage, certain kinds of cancer, and genetic disorders that went largely ignored. It's easy to have no observable health effects when you never look, the medical director of the Lawrence Livermore Lab said back in the 1980s, after seeing how the private contractors who ran Hanford studied the matter. In her jaw-dropping 2013 book, Plutopia, University of Maryland historian Kate Brown compares and contrasts American plutonium production at Hanford and its Soviet twin, Ozersk. The American understanding of the risks people ran when they came into contact with radiation may have been weaker than the Soviets. The Soviet government was at least secure in the knowledge that it could keep any unpleasant information to itself. Americans weren't, and so avoided the information, or worse. In 1962, a worker at Hanford named Harold Ardell, exposed to a blast of neutron radiation, was whisked to a hospital, where he was told he was perfectly okay except that he was now sterile, and it didn't even make the news. Instead, Hanford researchers in the late 1960s went to a local prison and paid the inmates to allow the irradiation of their testicles to see just how much radiation a man can receive before the tail falls from his sperm. We drive past Tea Plant, the long gray concrete building where they brought the irradiated material from the reactors, to cull the plutonium that went into the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki. Because it, too, is cold and dark, it is of less concern than the land surrounding it, for that is where the waste from the plant got dumped. The Nagasaki bomb contained about 14 pounds of plutonium, but the waste generated fills acres of manicured dirt, the texture of a baseball infield, just downhill from the plant. The tank farm, they call it, 177 tanks, each roughly the size of a four-story apartment building and capable of holding 1 million gallons of high-level waste, lay buried on Hanford's tank farms. 56 million gallons in the tanks are classified as high-level waste. What, you might ask, is high-level waste? Incredibly dangerous stuff, says Tom Carpenter, executive director of the Hanford Challenge, an organization that has monitored the site since the late 1980s. If you're exposed to it for even a few seconds, you probably got a fatal dose. And yet, as you drive by the tank farms, you would never know anything unusual was happening, were it not for the men crawling over it with scuba gear on their backs and oxygen masks on their faces. What we know about them, we know mainly from whistleblowers who worked inside the nuclear facility and who have been ostracized by their community for threatening the industry in a one-industry town. Resistance to understanding a threat grows with proximity, writes Kate Brown. 149 of the tanks in the Hanford farms are made of a single shell of a steel ill-designed to contain highly acidic nuclear waste. 67 of them have failed in some way and allowed waste or vapors to seep out. Each tank contains its own particular stew of chemicals, so no two tanks can be managed in the same way. At the top of many tanks accumulates a hydrogen gas which, if not vented, might cause the tank to explode. There are Fukushima-level events that could happen at any moment, says Carpenter. You'd be releasing millions of curies of strontium-90 and cesium, and once it's out there, it doesn't go away, not for hundreds and hundreds of years. The people who created the plutonium for the first bombs in the 1940s and early 1950s were understandably in too much of a rush to worry about what might happen afterward. They simply dumped 120 million gallons of high-level waste and another 444 billion gallons of contaminated liquid into the ground. They piled uranium, half-life 4.5 billion years, into unlined pits near the Columbia River. They dug 42 miles of trenches to dispose of solid radioactive waste and left no good records of what's in the trenches. In early May of 2017, a tunnel at Hanford, built in the 1950s to bury low-level waste, collapsed. In response, the workers dumped truckloads of dirt into the hole. The dirt is now classified as low-level radioactive waste and needs to be disposed of. The reason the Hanford cleanup sucks, in a word, is shortcuts, said Carpenter. Too many goddamn shortcuts. There is another way to think of John McWilliams's fifth risk. The risk a society runs when it falls into the habit of responding to long-term risks with short-term solutions. Project management is not just project management. Project management is the existential threat that you never really even imagine as a risk. Some of the things any incoming president should worry about are fast-moving: pandemics, hurricanes, terrorist attacks. But most are not. Most are like bombs with very long fuses that, in the distant future, when the fuse reaches the bomb, might or might not explode. It is delaying repairs to a tunnel filled with lethal waste until one day it collapses. It is the aging workforce of the DOE, which is no longer attracting young people as it once did, that one day loses track of a nuclear bomb. It is the ceding of technical and scientific leadership to China. It is the innovation that never occurs and the knowledge that is never created because you have ceased to lay the groundwork for it. It is what you never learned that might have saved you. Toward the end of his time as Secretary of Energy, Ernie Moniz suggested that the department, for the first time ever, conduct a serious study of the risks at Hanford. Once the risks were spelled out, perhaps everyone would agree that it was folly to try to turn it into, say, a playground. Maybe the U.S. government should just keep a giant fence around the place and call it a monument to mismanagement. Maybe the people at the labs could figure out how to keep the radioactivity from seeping into the Columbia River and leave it at that. Maybe it shouldn't be the DOE's job to deal with the problem, as the problem had no good solution, and the political costs of constant failure interfered with the DOE's ability to address problems it might actually solve. It turned out no one wanted to make a serious study of the risks at Hanford. Not the contractors who stood to make lots of money from things chugging along as they have. Not the career people inside the DOE who oversaw the project and who feared that open acknowledgement of all the risks was an invitation to even more lawsuits, not the citizens of eastern Washington, who count on the $3 billion a year flowing into their region from the federal government. Only one stakeholder in the place wanted to know what was going on beneath its soil: the tribes. A radioactive ruin does not crumble without consequences, and yet, even now, no one can say what these are. Here is where the Trump administration's willful ignorance plays a role. If your ambition is to maximize short-term gain without regard to the long-term cost, you are better off not knowing the cost. If you want to preserve your personal immunity to the hard problems, it's better never to really understand those problems. There is an upside to ignorance and a downside to knowledge. Knowledge makes life messier. It makes it a bit more difficult for a person who wishes to shrink the world to a worldview. There is a telling example of this Trumpian impulse, the desire not to know, in a small DOE program that goes by its acronym, ARPA-E. ARPA-E was conceived during the George W. Bush administration as an energy equivalent of DARPA, the Defense Department's research grant program that had funded the creation of GPS and the Internet, among other things. Even in the DOE budget, the program was trivial, $300 million a year. It made small grants to researchers who had scientifically plausible, wildly creative ideas that might change the world. If you thought you could make water from sunlight, or genetically engineer some bug so that it eats electrons and craps oil, or create a building material that becomes cooler on the inside as it grows hotter on the outside, ARPA-E was your place. More to the point, ARPA-E was your only place. At any given time in America, there are lots of seriously smart people with bold ideas that might change life as we know it. It may be the most delightful distinguishing feature of our society. The idea behind ARPA-E was to find the best of these ideas that the free market had declined to finance and make sure they were given a chance. Competition for the grants has been fierce. Only 2 out of every 100 have been approved. The people who do the approving come from the energy industry and academia. They do brief tours of duty in government, then return to Intel and Harvard. The man who ran the place when it opened was Arun Majumdar. He grew up in India, finished at the top of his engineering class, moved to the United States, and became a world-class materials scientist. He now teaches at Stanford University, but could walk into any university in America and get a job. Invited to run ARPA-E, he took a leave from teaching, moved to Washington, D.C., and went to work for the DOE. "This country embraced me as one of her sons," he said, "so when someone is calling me to serve, it is hard to say no." His only demand was that he be allowed to set up the program in a small office down the street from the Department of Energy building. "The feng shui of DOE is really bad," he explained. Right away, he faced the hostility of right-wing think tanks. The Heritage Foundation even created its own budget plan back in 2011 that eliminated ARPA-E. American politics was alien to this Indian immigrant. He couldn't fathom the tribal warfare. Democrat, Republican, what is this, as he put it? Also, why don't people vote? In India, people stand in line in 40 degrees Celsius to vote. He phoned up the guys who had written the Heritage budget and invited them over to see what they'd be destroying. They invited him to lunch. "They were very gracious," said Majumdar, "but they didn't know anything. They were not scientists in any sense. They were ideologues. Their point was the market should take care of everything." I said, "I can tell you that the market does not go into the lab and work on something that might or might not work." Present at lunch was a woman who, Majumdar learned, helped to pay the bills at the Heritage Foundation. After he'd explained ARPA-E and some of the life-changing ideas that the free market had failed to fund in their infancy, she perked up and said, "Are you guys like DARPA?" "Yes," he said. "Well, I'm a big fan of DARPA," she said. It turned out her son had fought in Iraq. His life was saved by a Kevlar vest. The early research to create the Kevlar vest was done by DARPA. The guys at Heritage declined the invitation to actually visit the DOE and see what ARPA-E was up to. But in their next faux budget, they restored the funding for ARPA-E. As I drove out of Hanford, the Trump administration unveiled its budget for the Department of Energy. ARPA-E had since won the praise of business leaders from Bill Gates to Lee Scott, the former CEO of Walmart, to Fred Smith, the Republican founder of FedEx, who has said that pound for pound, dollar for dollar, activity for activity. It's hard to find a more effective thing government has done than ARPA-E. Trump's first budget eliminated ARPA-E altogether. It also eliminated the spectacularly successful $70 billion loan program. It cut funding to the national labs in a way that implies the laying off of 6,000 of their people. It eliminated all research on climate change. It halved the funding for work to secure the electrical grid from attack or natural disaster. "All the risks are science-based," said John McWilliams when he saw the budget. "You can't gut the science. If you do, you are hurting the country. If you gut the core competency of the DOE, you gut the country." But you can. Indeed, if you are seeking to preserve a certain worldview, it actually helps to gut science. Trump's budget, like the social forces behind it, is powered by a perverse desire to remain ignorant. Donald Trump didn't invent this desire. He was just its ultimate expression. Chapter 2. People Risk. Ali Zaidi was 5 years old when his parents moved him from Pakistan to the United States in 1993. Later, he'd marvel at American parents who agonized over the trauma that some trivial relocation, say from Manhattan to Greenwich, Connecticut, might inflict upon their children. His parents might as well have put him in a rocket and shot him to the moon, and no one made any fuss at all about it. His father wanted to study educational administration. He loved the idea of helping to run the places people came to learn. And the one place he knew someone willing to teach him worked at Edinburgh University in northwest Pennsylvania. And so the Zaidis left Karachi, then a city of more than 8 million Muslims, for a town of 7,000 Christians. "We went from solidly upper middle class to trying to reach into the middle class," recalls Ali. The people in Edinburgh didn't have a lot of money, but Ali sensed that his family had less of it than most. "The other kids pay $1.50 for school lunch and you pay 50 cents. You know something is going on, but you don't really know what." There was no particular reason he needed to figure out what was going on, but in the most incredible way, he had. Even as a kid, he was interested in politics. That helped. He got that from his parents. They spent a lot of time talking about society, good and bad, justice, about what we owe people, said Ali. In rural Pennsylvania, most people were Republicans. Ali became a Republican, too. "I believe in personal responsibility," he said. "It's exciting when people come together because of their faith to do something for their community, to care about something more than themselves." In high school, he volunteered for America's Promise Alliance, Colin and Alma Powell's foundation to help poor children. He knocked on doors for the presidential campaign of George W. Bush. He ran track and excelled in the 400-meter dash. He was bright and ambitious and good at school. On a family trip to Boston, he got his first brief glimpse of Harvard and, without giving much thought to how he would pay for it, decided that was where he'd like to go to college. Faculty members at his high school thought Harvard was a bit of a stretch, and they encouraged him to apply to Penn State or the University of Pennsylvania, recalls Ali. He thought they were trying to lower his expectations. In the end, he applied to Harvard, and only to Harvard, because, as he put it, after you applied to one place, why would you waste money to apply to other places? Harvard admitted Ali to its class of 2008 and gave him financial aid. Around the same time, the CEO of America's Promise passed through rural Pennsylvania and asked to meet with volunteers. Ali went to a meeting, and one thing led to another. Before he knew it, Alma Powell, the group's board chairman, asked him to join the America's Promise board. At the time, he thought this was preposterous. The America's Promise board was filled with the biggest names in Republican politics and the CEOs of huge corporations. "I thought it was crazy," recalls Ali. "They'd fly me to D.C. and put me up in a hotel." The Iraq War happened. Guantanamo Bay happened. Hostility toward his fellow Muslims found a greater welcome in his party than elsewhere. Yet Ali remained a Republican. 6 or 7 months after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, he traveled there with America's Promise to help. In New Orleans, he saw poverty he'd never imagined. "They had to rebuild these schools, and the kids were effusive," he said. The thing that got me was that they weren't happy because they had just got their school back. They were effusive because suddenly they had a school that worked in the first place. If you had asked Ali, before he went to New Orleans, what he thought of people who didn't help themselves, he would have said, "My parents had to start all over again. What's the big deal? Just suck it up." The sight of little kids post-Katrina jolted him. It kind of blew my mind. If you are in kindergarten, you should at least get a fair shot. It was just eye-opening to see how much your geography could determine the opportunities available to you. Now he sensed that poverty came in many flavors. He'd been lucky to have his particular parents and his particular community. He was reminded of the first time he'd run on a track with spikes. You just fly on the track. The poor kids he saw in New Orleans were trying to run the same race in life that he was. But he was wearing spikes and they weren't. There's a real idealism that you have to indulge to think that people in New Orleans were now going to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. There were no bootstraps. He returned to college and rejoined the Harvard Republican Club. The surface of his life remained unchanged, but a new crackling sound in his head made the political program playing there more difficult to hear. One day, he attended a debate between his two most famous professors, Michael Sandel, the philosopher, and Greg Mankiw, the economist who had served as chair of George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisers. Someone got up and asked, "If you were a store owner after Katrina, should you hike up the price of flashlights?" Greg Mankiw said yes without hesitation. Ali remembers thinking, "Greg Mankiw is a good guy, but that answer is absolutely wrong. We don't just have markets, we have values." I started to think, "Ah, man, I'm probably not a Republican." A year or so later, he listened to a speech by the junior senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. One line from it stuck in Ali's head: "Poverty is not a family value." He worked as a field organizer in Obama's campaign. The biggest disappointment was that it was a little bit of a cliché, "Harvard liberal," said Ali. "Whereas my politics before were not a cliché." 2 years later, he graduated from Harvard, and then Obama was sworn in as President of the United States. Ali knew he had at least a shot at a very junior position in the new administration. "I had, for whatever reason in my mind, decided that I should go to the place where it wasn't sexy, but the sausage came together." That place, he further decided, was the White House's Office of Management and Budget. His first job in the new administration was to take the budget numbers produced by the senior people and turn them into a narrative, a document ordinary people could read. One day in his new job, he was handed the budget for the Department of Agriculture. "I was like, oh yeah, the USDA, they give money to farmers to grow stuff." For the first time, he looked closely at what this arm of the United States government actually does. Its very name is seriously misleading. Most of what it does has little to do with agriculture. It runs 193 million acres of national forest and grasslands, for instance. It is charged with inspecting almost all the animals Americans eat, including the 9 billion birds a year. Buried inside it is a massive science program, a large fleet of aircraft for firefighting, and a bank with $220 billion in assets. It monitors catfish farms. It maintains a shooting range inside its D.C. headquarters. It keeps an apiary on its roof to study bee colony collapse. There's a drinking game played by people who have worked at the Department of Agriculture. Does the USDA do it? Someone names an odd function of government, say, shooting fireworks at Canada geese that flock too near airport runways, and someone else has to guess if the USDA does it. In this case, it does. A small fraction of its massive annual budget, $164 billion in 2016, was actually spent on farmers. But it financed and managed all these programs in rural America, including the free school lunch for kids living near the poverty line. "I'm sitting there looking at this," said Ali. "The USDA had subsidized the apartment my family had lived in. The hospital we used, the fire department, the town's water, the electricity. It had paid for the food I had eaten." To prepare for the transition after the 2016 election, the USDA staff had created elaborate briefings for the incoming Trump administration. Their written material alone came to 2,300 pages in 13 volumes. A lot of people who work in the Department of Agriculture grew up on or around farms. They like to think of the Department of Agriculture as a nice, down-to-earth bureaucracy. They consider themselves more bipartisan and less ideological than people at the other federal agencies. "Our plan was to be as hospitable as possible," said one of the transition planners. "We made sure the office space was gorgeous." To make the Trump people feel at home, the USDA people had set aside the nicest rooms on the top floor of the nicest building, Whitten, with the nicest view of the National Mall. They had fished out of storage the most beautiful photographs from the USDA's impressive collection and hung them on the walls. They had brought in computers and office supplies and organized a bunch of new workstations. When they heard that Joe Leftwich, the guy Trump wanted to lead his USDA transition team, had been a lobbyist for PepsiCo, they brought in a mini fridge stocked with Pepsis. That was just the way they were at the USDA. They didn't think, how the fuck can people paid to push sugary drinks on American kids be led anywhere near the federal department with the most influence on what American kids eat? Instead, they thought, I hear he's a nice guy. No one showed up that first day after the election, or the next. This was strange. The day after he was elected, Obama had sent his people into the USDA, as had Bush. At the end of the second day, the folks at the Department of Agriculture called the White House to ask what was going on. The White House said they'd be here Monday, recalled one. On Monday morning, they worked themselves up all over again into a welcoming spirit. Again, no one showed. Not that entire week. On November 22nd, Leftwich made a cameo appearance for about an hour. We had thought, rural America is who got Trump elected, so he'll have to make us a priority, said the transition planner. But then nothing happened. More than a month after the election, the Trump transition team finally appeared. But it wasn't a team. It was just one guy named Brian Klippenstein. He came from his job running an organization called Protect the Harvest. Protect the Harvest was founded by a Trump supporter, an Indiana oil man and rancher named Forrest Lucas. Its stated purpose was to protect your right to hunt, fish, farm, eat meat, and own animals. In practice, it mainly demonized organizations like the Humane Society that sought to prevent people who owned animals from doing terrible things to them. They worried, apparently, that if people were forced to be kind to animals, they might one day cease to eat them. This is a weird group, says Rachel Bale, who writes often about animal welfare for National Geographic. One of the USDA's many duties was to police conflicts between people and animals. It brought legal action against people who abused animals, and so maybe it wasn't the ideal place to insert a man who was preternaturally unconcerned with their welfare. The department maintained its composure. No nasty leaks to the press, no resignations in protest. Even as Klippenstein focused bizarrely on a single issue. Not animal abuse, but climate change. He came in and wanted to know all about the office on climate change, says a former USDA employee. That's what he wanted to focus on. He wanted the names of the people doing the work. The career staffer running the transition politely declined to give Klippenstein the names. But he said he bore no ill will toward him for asking. Klipp, as he became known affectionately, had reassured everyone by saying, to anyone who would listen, that just as soon as this transition was over, he was going straight back to his small livestock farm in Missouri. Bless his heart, everything on the farm was still normal. And just you never mind why Uncle Joe likes to be alone with his favorite sheep. It was obvious to everyone inside the USDA that Klipp was in an impossible position. No one person could get his mind around all the things the department did. Just a couple of weeks before the inauguration, Klipp was joined by three other Trump people. The four-person team made a show of sitting down with some of the roughly 100,000-person USDA staff to hear what they had to say. These briefings lived up to their name. The entire introduction to the USDA's vast scientific research unit lasted an hour. At most of the federal agencies, there were no real briefings, says a former senior White House official who watched the process closely. They were basically for show. The Trump transition sent in these teams in the end just to say they were doing it. The Department of Agriculture normally closes for business on Inauguration Day, It's the only federal agency with an office building on the mall, which once upon a time had been the site of an experimental farm. The building is now used as a staging post during the inaugural by the National Guard and the Secret Service. Just before the inauguration, a Trump representative called the USDA and said he wanted the building to remain open, as he was sending 30-something new people in. Why the sudden rush? Why force the government to turn on the lights and staff the cafeteria and go to the rest of the trouble to animate a federal building on a day no one was working? Even getting people into the building would be difficult, with snipers on the roof and the metro station closed. A member of the Obama transition team wondered how the newcomers could have been vetted so quickly by the Office of Presidential Personnel. 9 months later, Politico published an eye-popping account about these new appointees. Jenny Hopkinson, a Politico reporter, obtained the curricula vitae of the new Trump people. Into USDA jobs, some of which paid nearly $80,000 a year, the Trump team had inserted a long-haul truck driver, a clerk at AT&T, a gas company meter reader, a country club cabana attendant, a Republican National Committee intern, and the owner of a scented candle company, with skills like pleasant demeanor listed on their resumes. In many cases, the new appointees demonstrated little to no experience with federal policy, let alone deep roots in agriculture, wrote Hopkinson. Some of those appointees appear to lack the credentials, such as a college degree, required to qualify for higher government salaries. What these people had in common, she pointed out, was loyalty to Donald Trump. 9 months after they'd arrived, a man I'd been told was the best informed of all the department's career employees about the haphazard transition couldn't tell me how many of these people were still roaming the halls. A few fingerprints they left were characteristically bizarre. They sent certified letters to several senior career civil servants perceived to be close to the Obama administration, telling them they were being reassigned from jobs they were good at to jobs they knew little about. They instructed the staff to stop using the phrase climate change. They removed the inspection reports on businesses that abused animals, roadside circuses, puppy mills, research labs, from the department's website. When reporters from National Geographic contacted the USDA to ask what was going on with animal abuse issues, they told us all of this information was public, except now you had to FOIA it, said Rachel Bale. We asked for the files, and they sent us 1,700 completely blacked-out pages. By the time I set out to get the briefings the Trump people had not, it was late summer. Of the 14 senior jobs at the USDA that required Senate confirmation, only one had been filled. Former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue was named Secretary of Agriculture in April. If Trump's interest in a subject is to be judged by the speed with which he appointed his cabinet secretaries, the Department of Agriculture has a catastrophically tiny share of presidential brain space. At any rate, I'd had a bunch of conversations with people who had run the department under past administrations, former secretaries and deputy secretaries of agriculture. They reached a bipartisan consensus. The best way to get a quick grip on the details of the department is to march through the seven little boxes of its organization chart. For example, if you want to know the likelihood that the geese loitering near the LaGuardia Airport runway will cause your plane to crash land in the Hudson River, and the event will become the subject of a major motion picture, you go to see the Undersecretary or Deputy Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, which oversees the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which handles the bewildering set of conflicts in America between people and animals. The people tend to get their way. If you want an up-to-date snapshot of which farmers are most dependent on federal aid, you go see the people who manage the little box marked Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services. These undersecretaries and deputy secretaries occupy public offices, but they are not really public figures. No one outside the department knows their names or faces, and their little boxes are not equally exposed to the whims and idiocies of any given presidential administration. The question of the day, at least it seems to me, is, where in these little boxes is the greatest damage likely to be done? Through neglect or mismanagement or malice? Take the little box labeled Natural Resources and Environment. It's not as abstract as it sounds. It employs around 40,000 people and contains the U.S. Forest Service. Its 193 million acres of forests and grasslands are important to the future of the climate. Its most recent undersecretary, Robert Bonney, was described to me by one of his superiors as maybe the single best undersecretary we've ever had. Bonney himself is a seriously interesting person and filled with concerns about what the Trump administration might do to his former department. But when I asked him to name his number one concern, he said, wildfires. But if you worry about everything, you wind up worrying about nothing. The Trump administration can forbid federal employees from using the phrase climate change more easily than it can prevent them from dealing with its consequences. The career people of the U.S. Forest Service, because they have direct lines into Congress, don't need the White House behind them in the way many other departments do. Fighting wildfires is the most visible thing the USDA does. It's the places in our government where the cameras never roll that you have to worry about most. Ali Zaidi had been the first to point this out to me, that the seven little boxes inside the Department of Agriculture are not equally vulnerable. And he would know. He'd spent 2 years as a grunt in the Office of Management and Budget before moving into ever more important White House jobs. He'd been one of those young people with a gift for getting old people to forget how young he was, and found himself thrust into jobs normally reserved for the middle-aged. In 2014, at the age of 27, he was put in charge of a team of experts overseeing the Department of Agriculture's entire budget, along with the budgets of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, the Department of Energy, the Department of the Interior, the Environmental Protection Agency, and a couple of others. He'd been forced to get his mind fully around the federal department that had underpinned his childhood. It wasn't easy. "Of all the budgets, it's the weirdest," he said. It was weird first, because the USDA did so many different things. It was weird because so many Americans had no idea how much their lives depended upon it. And it was weird because of the sheer sums of money sloshing around the place, dispensed by government employees no one had ever heard of. If you took a follow-the-money approach to what might go wrong inside the USDA, you ended up inside the box run by Kevin Concannon. I found Concannon at home in the woods of Maine. On the phone, he told me that he'd spent most of his career running health and nutrition services for several different states. Back in 2008, he'd retired to this place, purchased long ago with his wife. The woods were near the sea, and so they had bought a small boat. "I was sort of unhappy being retired," he said. "We had the boat, but after 2 weeks in the boat, we said, 'Okay, what are we going to do now?' I don't understand people who say they can't wait to retire. It's like living your life in jail or something." Not long after he'd had that thought, he got a call from the newly appointed Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. "I hired him for several reasons," said Vilsack, "but the first is heart." Concannon was pushing 70, but he came out of retirement to take charge of the box inside the USDA labeled Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. He'd run the place right up until the Trump people finally arrived in January 2017. In his job at USDA, Concannon had overseen for 8 years the nation's school lunch program, the program that ensures that pregnant women, new mothers, and young children receive proper nutrition, and a dozen or so smaller programs designed to alleviate hunger. Together, these accounted for approximately 70% of the USDA's budget. He'd spent the better part of $1 trillion feeding people with taxpayer money while somehow remaining virtually anonymous. We used to say if we stopped the tourists outside the building and told them what we were doing inside, most of them would have no idea that we were doing it, he said. He'd helped to prepare for the Trump transition, but of course, that transition never happened. He hadn't had a single encounter with anyone associated with it, nor had the Trump people bothered to speak with anyone who reported to him. And so it seemed fair to say, as Concannon had said to me on the phone, that they don't seem to be focused on nutrition. The Trump people were a bit like those tourists outside the Witten building. Only now they were inside it. Concannon's house is hidden from the road by trees, and so comes as a surprise. So does he. I had expected to meet an old guy with at least some need to convey a sense of his own importance. I expected him to retain at least a trace of the stuffy bureaucrat. Instead, I find myself being led through his retirement house by a leprechaun who has disguised himself by shaving his beard. "Media has not been a big part of my life," he says, laughing, as he leads me to a table and chairs out back. "This is new.